Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You are Locked On Jazz, your daily podcast on the Utah Jazz.
Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
It is Locked On Jazz for the 27th of September. Day one is in the books. Zach Lowe with an interesting observation. Kyrie with a flat earth quote? Not quite, but almost. And the impact of the new timeouts, plus get to know Howell Neto. And when you're done, you'll have a new favorite player. It's all coming up on today's edition of Locked On Jazz. Pow. How are you? I'm David Locke, radio voice of Utah Jazz, Jazz NBA Insider. Thanks so much for tuning into the show today. You can catch it on iTunes, your Android. You can tell Alexa that you want to play Locked On Jazz, and you can tell OK Google. Oh, don't say it. She's right there. She heard me. Uh-oh. You can tell Google to play Locked On Jazz as well. All right. Hope everyone's good today. Thanks very much for tuning in. Today's show brought to you by Grip 6. Grip 6 is a Utah-based belt company. Yes, and it is actually my... If you go and look at any of the, I don't know if you can see it. If you go and look at UtahJazz.com and you see the video of all of the interviews I did, I am wearing my Grip 6 belt while that was going on. I'll tell you a little bit more about them, Grip6.com, and you can get a 20% discount as well with the promo code LOCK20. All right, want to start off the show. First day of training camps in the books. I wrote a report at LockedOnJazz.net. It's available for you. You can check it out, LockedOnJazz.net. If you've got your favorite NFL team, check out that site as well. It's probably .com, and there's a daily podcast on that as well, as I'm sure you're well aware. So check out and make sure you see what's going on with all the sites now on the Locked On Podcast Network, coupling up with FanRag Sports. The first day, I think Quinn kind of sent the message. Donovan didn't quite grasp the message, but Quinn sent the message that he wanted, which was this is going to be about defense. If you look at the history of the NBA, if you're a top three elite defensive team, you make the playoffs. That's simple enough. You make the playoffs if you're a top three defensive team. Scott Skiles' team a few years ago was number one defensively, winning Milwaukee, and was 30th in the league defensively. And I think that was, and that's the outlier in this. They were 30th offensively. They were number one defensively. And I think they did not make the playoffs. Or at least they came awfully close to not making the playoffs. And I think they were 35 and 47 in that year. So I think they might be the one. They were fourth defensively and 30th offensively, and they didn't make the playoffs. So they weren't top three. I was wrong. So there may not be a team that's top three that didn't make it. And it was clear. They opened up on a defensive drill. They went to a defensive transition drill. That's where they spent most of the day, was working on defense. The other thing that is clear is a desire to do what we talked about yesterday, which was that a year ago, the Jazz used 21% of their possessions between 15 and 22 on the shot clock. And the league average, or the not even the league average, just the median team, really, was 30%. And that 21% was just too much of an outlier. And that the Jazz are really putting in a focus of trying to find a way to increase the pace in which they play. And as Quinn said on Media Day, the biggest impact is simply that they opened up almost with just with action, right? That after every single play or miss last year, they opened with action. And this year they're going to try to go otherwise. And to understand, you know, you take the median team between 15 and 18 on the shot clock last year. And, you know, so the middle team, you're just taking the median team. I'm just grabbing that median team. And you're at the Phoenix Suns. They were at 16% of their possessions. The high in the league was 20%. And the low in the league was Minnesota at 12, but the Jazz at 12.8 or 13%. And then you add in, that was from 15 to 18. Then you go even a little earlier to 18 through 22. The top teams are at 19%. So they're at 39%. The middle of the pack comes in at about 13.5. So you end up with 20 or 30% in the middle. And then you go to the Jazz who used it the least at 8%. And so the gap is the top teams are using 39% of their possessions. The Jazz are using 21 and the middle's 30. Somewhere the Jazz would like to swing into the middle of that pendulum. And that's where Donovan Mitchell said yesterday to the media, you know, high tempo basketball. I think there's a push to try to get some early paint breaks and action without waiting for the pick and roll. Push ahead, break it down, see what you can do. And it'll be interesting to see how these guys do that. Do we have, you know, I don't know if we have the personnel for that. And I don't know necessarily if we have guys that are going to do that particularly well. I don't know if that's who Rodney is. Rubio's a really poor finisher. Cephalosha probably. Joe probably not. So it'll be curious to see. Maybe Jarebko is a runner. Not particularly aware of that. This is curious to see of whether or not this happens. And so that was day one of practice. Sorry, I got to close the door. Zach Lowe, sorry, I had a comment or two about some of the world stuff and have just decided not to do it. Nothing too outrageous. We'll do it one day this week. All right, rather than me getting in trouble, let's talk about our friends at grip6.com. This has been neat for me because these guys reached out to me. I held some conversations with them. We talked about what we thought we could do. And they then sent me two of their belts, and they got me. Like, it's what I wear for my belt now. In fact, if you look at the UtahJazz.com video, as I said, I was wearing it. So let me tell you a little bit about their local company, Utah. BJ Minson is the owner and the inventor of the Grip 6 belt. Well, how are you an inventor of a belt? Well, it's the only belt that has no holes and no belt flap hanging out. Low profile, ultra lightweight, which makes it incredibly comfortable. As one of our guys, I think Derek Trujillo, emailed in, if you're a heavy dude, this is a game changer for you. I won't say names, but you should get this. No, grip6.com. So the buckles and straps are interchangeable, so you can customize how it wears. And so it comes, I don't know if I can explain this, right? It comes from the outside, goes through the hole, and then it hits their patent pending locking mechanism and holds tight all day. That is true. It never slips. It's cool. Go to the website. The first one up is the Ninja Belt. Very basic. That black lightweight with a black belt. You can get, if you're a golfer or want to do something more dramatic, they have a blue one. They have a green one. They have a big red one. You can change the colors. They have six different colors of the what your belt strap can look like. The buckles are $20. The straps are $15. And then use the promo code LOCK20 and you get 20% off. If you scan all the way down, then they've got some cool stuff. I like the Stickley. I'm going to have to get that. The Ruskin's nice also. I really like the Stickley. I have the carbon fiber dark matter, which is a little bit more expensive, but it's really sweet. They have one that's a little more businesslike and a graphite one. Check it out. Great selection. They've got some packages for you as well. Utah company, BJ and the crew have really, in their mind, built the best belt that's out there. And that's their goal. Great warranties on it. So If it doesn't work, they'll take care of it, but that's not going to happen. It's just terrific. Check it out. It is called grip6.com, and with the promo code LOCK20, you can get yourself a really well-priced, pretty awesome belt with some great versatility. Zach Lowe and Kevin Arnovitz did a great podcast. They're kind of the most interesting teams that they don't understand, and the Jazz were one of them. And I would agree with them. As I've said, I'm not entirely sure the value of defense, and I'm not entirely sure the value of depth. And those are the two things the Jazz have, is defense and depth. You know, our shooting could be really horrendous. And so I think it's going to be really curious to watch us. It was interesting because Arnovitz in the podcast talks about Dante Exum as the player he's most intrigued, and Zach didn't even have that on his list. Zach did have a note that I was unaware of that is pretty tremendous, and that is that all the Favors and Gobert numbers we talk about, Favors and Gobert together, have Gordon Hayward on the floor. And now all but 60 of them had Gordon Hayward on the floor last year. Now, when Gordon was off the floor in those 60 minutes, the Jazz were even better, but I would guess that's a pretty false pretense. You know, the Jazz, when Favors and Gobert on the floor together, are 96.5. When they were on the floor, 480 of those 480 minutes are with Gordon, 60 are without. So really hard to tell what that means. And it will be interesting to see then how successful Favors and Gobert are without Gordon. The other one that's interesting is they were even slower without Gordon at 89.7 possessions. I mean, we could be really incredibly slow, which then, you know, also is if you got these two bigs on and you're trying to run early in the action, you know, they're probably not involved at that point. But I thought that was a great point by Zach. I didn't know that so much of that is Gordon related. Speaking of Gordon, pretty funny quote yesterday. I had some fun with it on Twitter by Kyrie Irving, who just is, you know, got weird quotes. On Gordon Hayward, he's going to run the floor, be aggressive, play defense, offensive rebound, attack the defensive glass, do everything. Yeah, none of that mentioned being the second fiddle offensively to Kyrie. Run the floor, be aggressive, play defense, offensive rebound, attack the glass, and do everything. The other irony is that if he has a weakness, it's probably running the floor because he was overburdened with a workload, and offensive rebounding was 2.3%. I mean, that he was not an offensive rebounder. He can do everything, but it's just funny that Kyrie. You have a feeling that Kyrie doesn't know Gordon's game at all. Gordon gets slighted pretty easily, too. So it'll be curious to see there. I've had a bunch of people who've asked me again on the Joe Ingles Media Day questions, comments about Gordon. I'm not going to create something out of it. I don't think Gordon's reached out to people. I think Gordon left and Gordon left. Like, I don't think he's reached out to people. I don't think he's reached out to people, and I don't think he, you know, made a tremendous amount of phone calls on that day either. So I think we got to let it go, honestly. I'm kind of hoping, I know it's not going to happen. I'm kind of hoping by, what is it, March when they come into town. It's late, isn't it? Yeah, March 28th that we've moved on, but I'm pretty certain we won't have. And I get it. I want to talk about the timeouts this year in the NBA. So for those who do not know, there's a bunch of changes in the timeouts this year. It used to be, this is kind of geeky stuff. It used to be that in the whenever a whistle blew in the first quarter, under 6 minutes and under 3 minutes, that there was a timeout. And in the second quarter, it was under 9 minutes, under 6 minutes, and under 3 minutes. They have eliminated the under 9 minute mandatory timeout in the second and fourth quarters. So we're down to 8 mandatory timeouts. The other one that's worth noting is that each timeout is a minute longer. So that, okay. Then the next one is that each team will have 7 timeouts per game with no restrictions per half. So there's a lot of interesting things to this. So the mandatory timeouts will take 4 of your 7 timeouts, in theory. Or, if I'm reading this right, you could go use your timeout back-to-back, and we don't have a third one. So in other words, you start the game poorly, you call timeout. That classifies as the under at the 11-minute mark. That's the under 7. 5 minutes later, you're not playing well again. You call another timeout. That counts as the under 3. You've lost 2 of your 7 timeouts. And we just play. Each team can only enter the fourth quarter with 4 timeouts. So if you just took the mandatory and had it assigned to you, that's where you'll be, is 4 timeouts. But there's actually no reason to do that. You're better off calling one of the timeouts yourself, using a timeout, and then it will get dropped to 4 anyway. So you might even make sure you go with 3. The other team then hasn't used all of their timeouts probably, and you go down to 4. Each team will be limited to a maximum of 2 what are called team timeouts, and these are only a minute. After the 3-minute mark of the fourth quarter, or the secondary mandatory timeout. So it's the later of the 3-minute mark or the second mandatory timeout. Okay? So at that moment, you only have 2 team timeouts left. You used to have 1 full 220s. The last 3 minutes of the fourth quarter may have up to, but never exceeding, 5 timeout stoppages. So in other words, you have the mandatory under 3, and each team calls 2, and that's it. So that'll be much better for game flow. Here's what's really interesting on that. In all likelihood, teams are going to want to save 1 timeout to advance the ball in case you're down 1 late. When you're down 1 late, you can call timeout and move the ball forward to get that play run in the half court, which in some way means that we're down to 1 timeout per team in the final 3 minutes. So less substituting, less positional substitution, unless you're fouling. Teams are going to have to be smart and understand how they're playing and what they do, and understand their coaches. Continuity. Early in the year, well-coached teams should be in good shape. Now, what about game flow? So, the first one I just talked about is really interesting, is that it used to be that the Jazz took a timeout, and then if that was their assigned timeout, that's what it counted for, that under that mandatory, and then the next timeout would be counted to the Bulls. I'm assuming the Jazz are playing the Bulls in this scenario. Now, you just have 7 timeouts a game. You know you can't take more than 4 of them into the fourth quarter, and you really know you can't take more than 2 of them into the final 3 minutes. So there's a real answer that you probably could use, make sure you only go the fourth quarter with 3 of them, and you control the timeouts and when you call them much more than your opponent. You can call both the mandatory timeouts in the same quarter. From a Jazz standpoint, what would be really interesting is if Quinn decided to ever do that and make a game play long to tire teams out at altitude. The other thing is you are now guaranteed at least 5 minutes of action to open every quarter before the mandatory timeout, unless you force the coach to use his timeout, which may be fine. Maybe you force them. That's fine. It's not a big – it's just other teams have to be smart about it. But in regards to the idea of the Jazz running a little bit more and pushing, really coming out and pushing to open quarters, to me seems most important. You've got 5 minutes of action before the 7 minute timeout. Then let's say you call the timeout at 6:40. Now the next timeout, you never really have more than about 3.5 minutes of action without a timeout because you'll have a mandatory at 3. The other one that it gets interesting is the timeouts are much longer. The local timeouts, I guess last year were 2:15. I thought they were about 1:30. They're saying they were 2:15. They're now 2:45. So there's 30 seconds more time on every timeout. They're 3:15 on national TV games. So the Warriors are playing like 3 minutes of rest every time they have a timeout. There's some coaching and manipulation here that you can get a real edge as a coach and how you use it. And I think it's going to be better for game flow. I don't think it's going to make the game faster because the timeout's a little longer. And there's actually more inventory than there was. But I think that it's going to be interesting to see how it plays. No more 20-second timeouts, just team timeouts. Those are a minute 15. Quarter breaks are the exact same length as they were. Regular timeouts are 30 seconds longer. Halftime is a minute longer. The other one that will be interesting, by the way, is game ops. For game operations, they'll have to actually really keep the arena buzzing for an extra minute, which will be curious to see. So I think that'll have a huge impact. I'm going to probably write something up about, you know, how do you manipulate it? What do you do? What are the approaches? But I thought that it was worth talking about. All right, let's get to know Howell Neto. Really just a wonderful young man and very, very interesting to talk to. And here it is for you.
Let's get to know Howell Neto. If you took me back to your hometown, what would you show me? What would be the things you'd show me in your hometown?
I think my hometown, it's people there are great. So I'll take you to know all my friends, because I think that's one thing I appreciated from where I'm from. Take you for good views. My friend has a really nice house up in the mountain that you have a great view, and we always do barbecues there. So that's pretty much what I would show you there.
And what are the views of?
Views of the city. So all Belo Horizonte. That's where I grew up most of the time. And you can see the whole city, and we just sit there the whole day on a Sunday that when nobody works. So we just sit there all day, eat barbecue, and talk, and just spend some time together. That's what I do when I'm there.
What was your brothers? How many brothers and sisters did you have? What was the birth order in your family?
I got two brothers. Yeah, one just got a job in New Mexico, so he's moving there, and then my oldest brother, he lives in New Zealand, so we are three guys.
And what was it like? Was it always competing, or what was it like?
It's still competing. Every time we play video games, every time we do something that has this competitive side, we always like kind of fight each other, talk to each other, and it's pretty fun. I think that's what happened when you have three basketball players in the family. Both my two brothers play basketball growing up, so we are pretty competitive.
What's the first time you beat your older brother?
I think I was like 14 or 15. He was 17, and that's when I start like playing with his team. And sometimes I was playing more time than him, and it was kind of my dad was the coach, so we went home and and it was kind of crazy. We were having dinner, nobody talked to each other, and it was a weird situation. But yeah, that was that was the time when I started playing more than he and playing more than the professional. And
when you, if you took me back to your childhood room, what did it look like?
I used to sleep with my youngest brother, so we had this small TV and a lot of pictures on the wall about basketball players. I think Allen Iverson, Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan, all those pictures on the wall in my small bed and my brother's bed.
And you, if I remember correctly, well, I'll ask you, who was the player you always wanted to be when you were in the backyard?
I watched a lot of Steve Nash, and he used to play with Barboza, so I started watching the Phoenix Suns because of Barboza, and then I really liked Steve Nash, the way he played.
What was your first nickname?
Raulzinho, because it's little Raul. My dad's name is Raul, so that's still my nickname in Brazil.
Why do you wear the uniform number 25?
It was the number left. I got here, and I used to wear number 8 in Spain. I think we had a player using that number, and then I just got a 25 because he was there.
NBA is all about downtime. There's so much just empty time. What is your favorite thing to do in your downtime?
I'm usually tired, so I don't like going out a lot, going on hikings or being outside. So I just watch a lot of movies, a lot of TV shows, play some video games, spend time talking with my family on the phone, and go out to dinner. I like going to nice places to eat, and that's pretty much what I do when I'm not playing.
What's your favorite road restaurant?
My favorite road restaurant? There's a Brazilian place in New York that I found out my first year there that it's really good and bring me back home, so that's probably my favorite one. Memphis is pretty good. We always go there with the team. They have this barbecue, and it's pretty good too.
But Central barbecue?
Yeah, but I'll take that one in New York.
What is your guilty pleasure? Do you know what that phrase means? Like the thing you kind of, when you treat yourself or all right, I'm not going to be an NBA player for a second. I deserve this. Or what is your, do you have a food or a...
Yeah, I think it's candies. I love all these gummy bears and all those kind of candies, and sometimes I just, like, we have a lot of on the plane and in the practice facility, but I try to not eat a lot. But sometimes it's just I'll say, okay, I had a good game or I had a good practice. I'll say I can give me a little gift.
All right, let's go. There's two really interesting books. One called Grit by Angela Duckworth. The other's Talent Code by Daniel Coyle about elite performance. What made you, in the process of your career, believe you were going to make it? How come you believed you were going to make it?
You know, it was kind of when I was a kid, 12, 13 years old, I had some crazy things on my mind that I was going to be an NBA player and I was going to be a basketball player. And I remember talking to my friends and they were like, oh, are you crazy or are you cocky or that's never going to happen. So I always had that on my mind. I never know if it was going to be truth, but I always had that on my mind and I always believed it. I remember like telling my dad if he could put a basketball board in my backyard so I could practice and I would pay him back when I got money from basketball and like all those kind of things that kids like believe it. And but I always believed in myself and I'm here now.
What gave you that hope, do you think?
I think I was always, I had talent and I was always a little better than my other teammates when I was a kid. I played a lot of sports. I played soccer, I played volleyball, I played a lot of sports, and I was pretty good on those kind of sports. And I don't know, I just believed it and I knew that if I worked hard, I could make it. And I worked hard, I still work hard now, and that's how I am.
If you think back about when you were a kid, how were you different than the other kids? Like, what did you maybe do that they weren't willing to do, or where were the moments where you separated yourself?
I was really passionate about the game, and I was really competitive. I remember sometimes too competitive. I remember going to school, and we had like those games in school, and I was yelling to all my teammates because they wouldn't do whatever I want to do, and they wouldn't care because they were just kids. They wouldn't care if they lose or win. And I remember everybody hated me. Everybody on my team hated me. And my dad had to come one day to me and say, hey, you're gonna go there and apologize your coach, apologize your teammates, apologize everybody because you're being a bad guy and you're just telling like bad things to all the other teammates. And I was really competitive. That's why I did it. I never meant to insult somebody or just be a bad guy. But sometimes you have to. If you're competitive and you want to win, you got to be that guy. So I did that when I was young, and I got better when I get older.
In the book, Grit, they talk about being gritty as kind of two things. One of them is perseverance. We'll talk about that in a second. The other is to resist complacency. I don't know if you know the English word complacency. So, you know, whatever it takes to improve. When did you first kind of see that in yourself, or how did you avoid that complacency?
I have grit. I think I have grit playing. I have grit working, and I think that's the way you're going to get on top. Even if you're really talented, if you don't work and if you don't have grit, you're not gonna be the best of you. And I put that on my mind, not only on basketball and everything. If you're going to do something for school, if you're going to do a paper for school or whatever you're doing, if you don't give everything of you, it's not worth it. It's just, you're just losing time. And I put that on when I'm playing. I put that on when I'm working. And I think that's the way I got here and I'm here today.
In Talent Code, they talk about deliberate practice. And he talks about acute practice. So he actually talks about the great Brazilian soccer players who are all from this kind of ghetto where they don't have soccer fields, but they play this some game in the alley. You're nodding, so maybe you know what I'm talking about. In the alleyway with these little balls, and so that when they then get out on the soccer field, they're so much more skilled with their feet because they have all this space. So it's this, he called it acute practice or deliberate practice, things that are just, you know, so minute or pushing you beyond yourself. What would be your examples of that in your career?
I had that growing up because the club that I was playing basketball, we didn't have a lot of money. So all the balls we had was kind of old. It was kind of really, really bad. The court wasn't even like this court that we play right here. It was kind of like playing in the street. So I remember every time like people were asking for better balls. Like, I want to get that ball because probably we had two nice balls and then two nice basketballs and then six or eight other trash basketballs. So I would, after my coach told me that, I would always take the bad basketball because if you work dribble on that basketball, if you get a better basketball, you're gonna be better. So that's my example of that, and I think it works. I think it's truth.
You know, it's interesting also on that kind of, I don't know if you know about this, but in baseball there's a bunch of the shortstops are all from this small town, the Dominican, and they talk about it's because all the fields are terrible. So that when they then go out and play on good fields, it's so easy for them.
Yeah,
it's the same thing.
They feel great. They feel great because they're used to a bad thing. And then once you got a nice thing, you're going to feel great. And you're going to give you, like, motivation to be better.
What does perseverance mean to you? And what would be an example in your life of perseverance?
I think being a 6'1 guy, white guy coming from Brazil, where everybody plays soccer and hurt from a lot of people that you're not going to make it and you're not going to make it, and you just try, work hard every day, and I'm here. So I think that's one example. There's a lot of like soccer players, that a lot of people from my country that coming from there, they say they're not going to make it. I think all the NBA guys playing in the league, the Brazilian NBA guys are example of that too.
There's a few quotes I like. One of them is that superlative performance is really a confluence of a dozen small skills, each learned into a larger habit. What would be your example as a basketball player of the tiny small skills that you've mastered that allow you to play?
I think everything in basketball is so many details that sometimes it's like, if you're shooting that way, one little movement that you do, that one little change that you do in your shot is going to make you like have more shots and have a better percentage. So I think everything is one in the weight room. If you're doing something wrong, you might get hurt, or you might not get better as if you're doing the right thing. I think basketball, it's all about details and these small things that you gotta improve it every day.
What gets you out every day? What makes you come back when you're tired and it's 11 days in a row? What brings you back out the next day?
I think my family, I think I'm where everybody from my family wanted to be. My dad always dreamed about being a NBA player. My two brothers always dreaming about being a professional player, and I'm here. I have this opportunity, and I just put everything I have for them and for me. I think I have the opportunity. I don't wanna waste it. I don't wanna lose that opportunity. So every time I wake up, sometimes it's tough because you have a lot of practice, you have a lot of games. Sometimes we go through like 14, 15 days without one day off, so it's pretty hard. But those days that you feel bad or you feel tired, you just gotta think that you got an opportunity that probably 100,000 people wanted to be in your spot.
All right, that was awesome. Now let's do the fun stuff quickly.
Yeah,
Travels with Charlie was a John Steinbeck book. You live Travels with Rudy. What's it like traveling with Rudy?
It's fun. It's kind of stressful sometimes because he want to do all his time. He want to do all whatever like he wants to do. He want to choose all the spots we're going. So we kind of just got to relax and let him decide what we're doing more. When I was in France, when I was in Brazil, I was kind of trying to like tell him where to go, but he still wanted to go like whatever he wanted to go. So, but it's pretty fun, you know. He's a nice guy. I've been hanging out with him for those 2 years that I'm here, and it was pretty fun. I got to know his hometown. I got to know his country. He came back to came down to Brazil, so I showed him a little bit of Brazil. So it was fun.
You're 6'1", so if you want to go out, you can probably hide. If you're with Rudy, you can't hide. He's 7'2", people see him. What's it like being with a 7-footer?
You know, it's kind of crazy because a lot of people know him, but a lot of people doesn't know him. They just ask for pictures or they just ask for something because he's 7'1". So people are coming like, can I take a picture? And he's like, yeah. So you think they know him. And then after the picture, he's like, what's your name? What do you do? What do you play? And I'm like, come on, man. Why are you taking a picture with someone that you don't even know who it is? So it's nice. You have like everything has the bad things and the good things. But that's one of the things that I kind of got tired of it. Not because they ask for pictures, but because they don't know who he is and they still wanna get a piece of that. But it's fun, you know. It's nice getting to know people and getting to see how many people like follow basketball. More in Brazil, a lot of people like follow basketball. We went to the NBA store and there was like 1,000 people outside waiting for us just for like a picture and autograph, and people were waiting for 5 hours in the line. It was one of the craziest things I've ever seen, and a lot of people were there for 3-4 hours and they didn't even get a autograph or a picture because we had to go. We were there. We're supposed to be there for 1 hour, and we were there for almost two, and there is still like 200 people waiting for an autograph. So it's pretty fun. It's pretty cool.
Do you ever have funny experiences where they don't realize you play also when you're with Rudy? They just think you're hanging out with him?
Yeah, they just think I'm, I don't know, his assistant or his friend or whatever. But I'm good with that. Sometimes I just wanna walk around like a normal person, and I don't want nobody to bother me. So that's good that I'm only 6'1" and not 7'1".
Pleasure talking with you, my friend.
Yeah.